Our panelists come with a great background in either working in, running their own or others, or researching and analyzing campaigns and elections in Oklahoma and really nationwide. I really feel that these people are some of the most knowledgeable people on Oklahoma politics and elections in the state. We're going to start with each panelist giving about 5 to 7 minutes, and then I have a question or two I can start with, and then we'll open it up for everybody else to ask questions as well. So first we'll have Dr. Keith Gaddy from OU.
Hey, how are y'all doing today? Very good, very good. It's always nice to make the trip back up the turnpike to green country because you are reminded of just how diverse Oklahoma can be. I do have a couple of slides I'm going to share with you, and since it's my understanding this is going to be rebroadcast on KGOU, I will make sure they have these visuals. Radio being such a compelling visual medium, we need to make sure we do this thing. All righty. Real quickly, usually this talk starts off, I walk up and I say, well, you know, the Democrats haven't sounded bottom yet, but they're headed that way. I think they may have finally about gotten there. But what I want to do in order to set up this talk is just give you a couple of pieces of information, since this is a younger audience, to visualize the change of Oklahoma, okay? So first thing I want to do is show you that if you look at Oklahoma before about 1994, it is a Democratic-dominated state. This first graphic I'm showing you, which comes from my forthcoming book with Bill Shepard on Oklahoma politics, shows the degree of control, the frequency with which Republicans have controlled either winning the presidential electors, winning the Senate seats, the various congressional districts, controlling the state legislature, or controlling the governorship. And as you can see, before about 1970, the first two-thirds of the graphic, Republican squares indicating control are rare and mainly focused in the congressional seats and occasional presidential wins. Then after 1994, Democratic wins are even more rare. You get to 1994, there's a dramatic realignment of Oklahoma politics. For most of the people in this room, this is your lifetime, the Republican ascendancy in state politics. And the most recent election is the only election where Republicans have run the table on everything, controlling all the congressional representative seats, all the statewide elected seats, the state legislative seats, the governorship. Okay? Part of what's been happening is a systematic decline of the Democratic Party. We've had a decline in Democratic registrants over two generations, from 80% of registered voters being Democrats to about 48%. The Republicans, in the meantime, have gone from 20% up to about 44%. And at some point in the next 4 years, they will probably flip positions in terms of being the predominant party. But that doesn't tell the whole story. If you were to take a look at winning state legislative seats by Republicans compared to winning over voters, winning legislative seats and converting registered voters for most of the history of the state went on a one-to-one basis. Republicans would pick up a percentage point of registered voters, pick up a seat in the state legislature. Then you get to 1996. And Republican office holding just takes off like a rocket ship headed for orbit. It departs from the general trend of Republican registration gains, and these huge pickups are made in terms of representative position, even though the maps under which these officials are elected were drawn by Democratic legislatures. So there's something bigger going on. What's going on is we've seen the politics of the state sort out into a few dimensions. Bill Shepard and I did some survey work a couple of years back where we asked voters their degree of agreement with different party platform positions across the two parties. And then we factor analyzed this data to see where the clusters of common issues were in the Oklahoma electorate. And what we found is there are two dominant dimensions that exist in Oklahoma politics. There's what we would call the modern agenda factor. And people who fall on this dimension strong, they think human beings are contributing to climate change. They want to repeal the Bush tax cuts. They want universal health care. They oppose school vouchers, support affirmative action, want to keep Social Security public rather than private. They support civil unions and gay marriage. And they support stem cell research, a very modern National Democratic Party agenda. Okay? This is the number one dimension in Oklahoma politics. Either you're strong for it or strong against it. You talk to somebody on any one of these issues, you know where they reside on almost all these issues. The second dimension is what we call the populist nationalist dimension. You want lower family taxes. English is the official language. Tax relief for seniors. Get rid of the state income tax. You want to be able to impeach activist judges, and you want to have parent citizenship instead of birth citizenship. Now, this is the second biggest dimension. This dimension, it's possible to have strong populist nationalist opinions on these issues in Oklahoma, but also have kind of a modernist perspective on these other issues. So the second set of issues and the first set of issues don't necessarily go together. Then there are three smaller clusters that exist: social moralism, what we call the Ron Paul factor, the extreme libertarian dimension in Oklahoma politics, and then people that are really strong on religious freedom. They don't want religious dogma in the classroom. They don't want religious establishment. They also don't want teachers conflicting with what is taught at home. And then we've got a bunch of little spur issues: prescription drugs, lottery gaming, homosexuality is a chosen lifestyle, the ability of the government to seize your property. If you look at the politics of the state, most of the fights are occurring on the big two dimensions. This is where campaigns seem to be won or lost in this state. The problem is, if you look at the voters that have the strongest preferences, they tend to have the strongest, most common preferences, overwhelming support for what we would call dimension two, the populist nationalist perspective, or for a conservative perspective on the modernist agenda. And this is where the real dilemma is for the Democrats, is that the issues that matter most to Oklahoma voters, they tend to be loaded on the Democrats are loaded on the wrong side of where most voters are. So even if you stripped away party and just ran campaigns on these issues without party label, Democratic candidates tend to end up on the wrong side of the division of the electorate on most of the issues that matter to the public in the state. At this point, I'm just going to kick it over to Ryan or Pat, Megan, whoever you want next, and then we'll go from there. Thank you.
We'll go ahead and give, since Ryan got thrown into this late, we'll go ahead and let Pat come up. Pat is a political analyst and consultant and lobbyist for CMS Strategies. He's run many statewide campaigns, both issues and candidates, and does polling and other things and lobbying as well. So.
Well, thanks for having me here. I started to say that maybe Keith and I should have coordinated a little bit better, but yeah. Instead, I'm going to give you a pop quiz on what he just said. Okay. I look at things historically as well and want to look at these, and so I'll ask you, when was the last time Oklahoma voted for a Democrat for president? It was just on the chart. 1964, okay. When was the last time in an open U.S. Senate race, we'll take out the factor of incumbency, that Oklahoma voted for a Democrat for U.S. Senate? You're right. So 14 years later. When was the last time Oklahomans elected a majority of the congressional delegation as Democrats? 1992, another 14 years. All right. Okay, then it breaks down. We took control of the legislature too quick. So then in 2002, 10 years later, was the last time that Democrats had elected a majority of people to the legislature. So we've got this. It's been a long – it's not been as dramatic and as quick as some of the numbers show you to believe. But what's happened, it's been a slow and steady climb that then when it hit a tipping point, then it escalated exactly as Keith talked about here. So again, that's kind of where we're looking at. But it's fascinating here when I look at his issues here. We haven't coordinated this, but this is exactly how we look at campaigns and elections. It's nice when academia and practicality meet the same situation here. The shorthand for this on politics, you're not as bright as you are in academics. So it's God, guns, and gays is kind of the shorthand for some of this here. But I mean, seriously, if you look at this, the agenda factor one, human beings changing Earth's climate. Where is Jim Inhofe on that issue? Does anybody know? it really is. I mean, this really dives out where it is. And so what has happened is we actually have a natural alignment now. To me, the question isn't why we're so Republican now. It's why we were Democrat for so long before. I've got polling data dating back to the early 80s where we asked people, One question we ask, do you vote for the Republican or the Democrat candidate? This is 1980. 48% of the people said they voted for the Democrat candidate, only 24% the Republican. We asked them, are you a conservative or a liberal? 65% said conservative, 30% said liberal. Today, we asked people, do you vote for the Republican or Democrat candidate? We're about 56% say the Republican. We asked people, are you conservative or liberal today? 65% say they're conservative, 30% say they're a liberal. For 35 years, where I've got the data for, it's been consistent. That conservative number hasn't varied 2 to 3 points any time through any of any substantial notice at all. So we've been consistently, who Oklahomans are, quite frankly, hasn't changed. Our alignment with our party has. Other things that have changed the same, that have stayed the same, our religiosity. We're one of the three or four most religiously observant states in the nation. More than 60% of Oklahoma voters, now this is just voters, not all of Oklahomans, but voters attend church on at least a weekly basis. That has been consistent for at least 35 years for which I have data. We're also pretty homogeneous. Despite having the diversity of land and all the different geographic regions, we're pretty white to a great extent. That's where we've been in the past. So what has changed? The other thing I'll say that's there is our populism. We are an incredibly populist state. We continue to have that. And that's actually one thing that has been constant that is really, for Republicans, is one of the real problems we're going to have, one of the real issues we're going to have to deal with. If you really want to go back and read something on Oklahoma history, it's one of my favorite books. It's OU Press put it out. Mark Jefferson and Jesus in the Oklahoma Countryside, A History of Agrarian Socialism. It's a great book. People forget about Oklahoma's history. We were Eugene Debs as a socialist candidate back in the first part of the 20th century. We were its number one state. The interesting thing about Oklahoma, socialism and communism, we were kicked out of the international communist movement. People don't realize that. We weren't allowed to be a part of the international communist movement in Oklahoma for one reason. We wouldn't buy the tenet that religion was the opiate of the people. The Pentecostal Holiness Church was the centerpiece of the network in Oklahoma in the tens and the teens. And that dichotomy is what sets Oklahoma apart, I think, from most any other state in the nation that I've had the luxury to research. But it's that populism combined with that high religiosity. So what's changed? Why have Oklahomans changed? I actually think it's because of information. I think it is the proliferation of cable news that has caused Oklahoma to rapidly change. We, for decades, had Oklahoma Democrats, be it Bob Kerr, be it David Bourne, be it Glenn English, be it Dave McCurdy, be it those that predate them, where they were able to be, I'm an Oklahoma Democrat or I'm a born-again Democrat. those allowed an insulation from the national party. But what's happened with cable news is we are seeing the national Democrat agenda more and more in Oklahoma. As Keith pointed out, the voters here value system is differently. And so Democrats no longer have that buffer anymore. I'll tell you that the nail in the coffin, I think, realize my daughter's a freshman in college. She's going to school here at TU, actually. So I have to remind myself that she wasn't born when this ad aired. In 1994, people talk about the Jim Inhofe, Dave McCurdy race that we had. And I don't know if you followed it at all, but the one that got all the attention was about some prisoners in tutus getting federal money on prisons for dance lessons. It didn't move numbers. What moved numbers was a video that they had that had Dave McCurdy repeatedly second the nomination of Bill Clinton, where they just ran it in a loop with him raising his hand saying, I second the nomination, I second the nomination, I second the nomination of Bill Clinton, that tied him to the National Democrat Party. And I really feel that was one of the real nails in the coffin of the Democrat Party in the state. So we'll get into discussions here. I want to get off here a little bit. But I do want to just throw a few things out here for the future. What will change? Are we on a trajectory that's not going to be here forever? We are undergoing a significant shift in the base of the two parties right now. Traditionally, the urban areas and the rural Northwest has been the Republican base with the Democrats in the other areas. That is starting to change. For discussion, I don't know if I fully believe this, but I like to tell people at times that I predict that the seat in Edmond that Ken Miller used to represent will be Democrat before the one in Ardmore that's represented by Pat Ombey now, because we're having that sort of a shift in Oklahoma. Now, it might be 40 years away, but I do believe that to be the case. We've got the populism, and one of the real questions is how do the Tea Party and the social conservatives interact, and what's the effect our closed primary system has on Republicans able to nominate people who are electable in general elections? And to tell you how quickly things can change, the last thing I want to talk about is, anybody have an idea of what happened in the 2006 elections? You guys were alive then, I hope. All right. After the 2006 elections, yes, Republicans won Congress. Republicans win a majority in the state legislature. But after the 2006 elections, only two of the 9 statewide offices are held by Republicans, and they're both corporation commission seats. Every other seat is held by a Democrat. In 2010, it's a Republican clean sweep. But it hasn't been that long ago. So Republicans, if they're complacent and think that they're in this state and they're going to be there forever, there's some real concerns. But I will tell you, the Democrats aren't doing themselves any favor right now, because I ask you guys, you guys are informed people, think of one Democrat candidate for a state office this next cycle.
So. You mean other than R.J. Harris?
He's running as a Libertarian or Independent. I don't think he's running as a Democrat.
He announced he's running as a Democrat.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
Okay.
I'm here to announce my candidacy for now. As Megan said, I've got about 45 minutes to prepare for this, and I appreciate Keith and Pat going ahead of me to give me some fodder to respond to. There's this sense that there's been a debate, right? When we look at these different dimensions here, I think that there's an assumption that there's been a debate on both sides of these issues. When we look at, and I can't read them from here, but climate change. Has there really been a debate about climate change in Oklahoma? And was that debate something that was had? Was it the public? Were they hearing both sides in the media? Were they hearing both sides from their elected officials? And then they decided that man-made climate change was something of a hoax, and they went with Jim Inhofe? I don't think they did. And so I think that when we think about these dimensions, it's very important to remember, even though the numbers are where they're at, they didn't get there because there was this robust debate, there was this robust dialogue among the electorate. And then the people of Oklahoma just said, okay, well, we're going to be on this side. I think it's much more a function of there not being that dialogue or that debate not occurring in the first place. The information that Pat referred to that Oklahomans are getting, and the information that allows the National Party, the National Democratic Party, to become the face of the Democratic Party in the state of Oklahoma, I think that there again, that's very one-sided, and it's one-sided both not because, you know, folks are watching Fox News, because the Daily Oklahoman and even sometimes now the Tulsa World is a little bit to the right, or a lot to the right, depending on where you're at. But I also think that it's one-sided from the standpoint that you don't see very many Democratic elected officials embracing the ideas of the Democratic Party and then defending them in the state. Instead, you see them retreating. You know, so instead, what we have in Oklahoma is this dynamic of one party that starts with all of the numbers already in their favor, and they just run full steam ahead. And then you have the other party that, in the wake of these just hemorrhaging seats in the legislature, hemorrhaging statewide offices, the strategy there, if you could call it a strategy, has really been to retreat and to play defense and not go on the offense. And so, you know, that's where I think that we see where we're at, right? I mean, you listed off a lot of, you know, very notable Democrats in Oklahoma's modern contemporary history that were people that often stood up against the National Democratic Party. But we also, every once in a while, you have a Mike Sinar that falls in there. And in the state legislature, you have folks like Jeannie McDaniel from Tulsa that fall in there. But their numbers are so small in comparison to the most of the other members of the Democratic constituency and those, and most importantly for this case, elected Democrats, that they've not really been able to move the dialogue in a way that's on the counteroffensive. You know, looking forward, I see the gains that Republicans have made is untenable to hold on to for the long term. We heard, you know, 40 years. I hope that it's not 40 years. For me personally, right, I work for a nonprofit. We're a nonpartisan organization, but I'm a Democrat. So that's me speaking as a former Democratic member of the legislature. I hope that it's not 40 years, but we can see this, right? So my former House seat, which is mostly comprised of Seminole County, was represented by me. I was ranked as the most liberal member of the Oklahoma legislature when I left by the Oklahoma Constitution newspaper for the last 2 years that I was there. Now it's represented by one of the most conservative members in the Oklahoma legislature, a guy named Tom Newell. And that happened in the matter of one election cycle. And I don't think that – and before me, it was, you know, Dan Boren was in that seat. I mean, this is a – it was the seat that David Boren once held in the legislature. So I do think that we're going to begin to see this urban-rural realignment. And I think that when we look at the demographic changes, that's where it becomes most untenable for Republicans to hold on to the gains that they've made. And it makes it presents an opportunity both for Democrats, but it also presents an opportunity for some Republicans as well. We have some Republicans in this room. And I won't name names, but you know, they have been they have been at times targets of their own party because they have not followed the script. Well, I think that there's going to be an opportunity for some Republicans as well as some Democrats with these changing demographics to not just be the person that's the sacrificial lamb on the ballot. You know, not just the person that gets up there and runs and loses, but can actually make some reasoned arguments to the electorate and begin to have that dialogue and also stand a chance to win. It's going to be very difficult. I don't think it's going to take 40 years, but I think it's going to be very difficult in the next decade for any candidate of either party to win office in most legislative districts and statewide office even if they're opposed to legal contraception. I think it's going to be very difficult maybe in the next 10 or 15 years in the state of Oklahoma for somebody to get elected to a metropolitan office and at least two congressional seats if you're opposed to gay marriage. I think that when we start talking about technology and privacy issues, you're going to begin to see a marriage between liberals and progressives and Tea Party affiliated Republicans that I think will resonate with the voters in a way that changes the dynamics considerably. So looking at the last 20 years, my caution would be to anyone is to not look at that as a roadmap of how things are going to continue to be, but rather as a roadmap of how quickly things can change. And I think that we're really at a point where the demographics of the state of Oklahoma are changing so rapidly that we can begin to see that kind of a realignment. And it's really just a matter of which party stands up and embraces that. I haven't really seen it from a majority of either party right now. I sure haven't seen Democrats as a majority speaking in terms of elected Democrats stand up and embrace women's rights the way I feel they ought to. I haven't seen them stand up and embrace LGBT equality. I haven't seen them embrace privacy rights. And neither party has really stood up on some of the most pressing social and fiscal issues that are surrounded in corrections and criminal justice reform the way they ought to. So all that together puts us in a point in our history where everything, I think, is up in the air. And it's just a matter of who's going to seize that and move forward with it.
Okay, great. I think those were great opening remarks that should lead to some really good questions. Each of the three panelists kind of mentioned the changing demographics in the state and kind of alluded to how that has changed now, but I think there are some real questions on in the future what that will, how that will look. So would you guys address how you think both the party structures will deal with the kind of the growing influential Native American presence in the state, additionally the growing Hispanic population, and how both of those groups could impact our elections and campaigns going forward?
As Pat pointed out, for most of the history of Oklahoma, this has been a white electorate. The electorate in Oklahoma, depending on the election, will be anywhere from 82 to 92% Anglo-white in most elections for the last three decades. But there's a sea change coming. This map that I've thrown up in front of y'all shows the counties where the citizen population under 18 is either at least 40% or 50% non-white, non-Anglo-white. So it's either some combination of Hispanic, African American, Native American, or Asian American. And if you look at it, what you see is the three big major metro counties have got citizen populations under 18 that are over 40% non-white. They'll approach 50% non-white in the next 5 years. And if you go 20 years out from now, a majority of Oklahomans under the age of 40 are not going to be Anglo-whites. They're going to be Hispanic, African-American, Asian-American, or American Indian. And these are electorates where the GOP has not had a lot of success in outreach. This is an electorate where they have been able to find candidates, but they've not been able to find voters. And this is what the Republicans right now are in a position the Democrats were in ages ago. They have a surplus of votes to work with now and a surplus of seats to work with. But that's going to change probably not in the next 5 years, the next 10 years, but we get 15 years out. They're confronting a very different electoral environment that is already confronting other Republicans around the country in Georgia, Florida, South Carolina, and probably in the next 5 years in Texas. So I'm curious to see what the GOP does, but it means that part of what they have to do is attenuate a lot of the rhetoric or policy that appeals to an old white base that's very different from the electorate that's coming up behind it.
I think the key thing Republicans have to do on this is recognize that the fact that they're actually having the discussion now, there are some that are doing it, I think gives them time to address this issue. But it's the number one challenge Republicans have. Now, what I will mention on that is that I don't think the Democrats are without their own challenges on this issue as well, because their base is old and white as well. Mm-hmm. In fact, the Democrat Party chairman, just a couple of years ago when they had the primary for president, you might recall, I think it was 14 counties in Oklahoma, in the Democrat primary, voted against Barack Obama.
Yeah.
And he said it was because of racism. So he recognized himself that 44% of – he basically called 44% of his own voters racist when they didn't vote for the incumbent president. So there are issues there that we're going to have to deal with. I do think the Republicans in this state have actually done a pretty good effort of letting people know that if you believe the same values, you have the same structure, you've got a chance for opportunity and success here. I know a lot of people talk about the current speaker being African American and Native American. The Hispanic caucus is led by a Republican in the State House. So we do have, and we've got numerous Native Americans there as well. In fact, there are only two Native American, enrolled Native American members of Congress, and they're both from Oklahoma and they're both Republicans.
Now, I'd like to just pick up on where the Democratic Party has its own problems. You go back to, I believe it was 2006 when House Bill 1804 came up, which was at the time the most punitive anti-immigrant piece of legislation that was being considered in the nation. When Oklahoma passed that and Governor Henry signed it into law, Senate Bill 1070 that was passed in Arizona that ultimately went to the United States Supreme Court, that was the progeny of House Bill 1804, and you had a majority of Democrats that voted for that. That was not a partisan split in the legislature. That was a split between a very small minority of Democrats, maybe a couple of Republicans. I think maybe Senator Harry Coates voted against it, but it wasn't. It wasn't by any means a demonstration of a partisan split on immigrants' rights in the state of Oklahoma. If the Democratic Party or any party is going to take advantage of the changing demographics in the state of Oklahoma, they can't wait until 20 years from now when these numbers on the map are the way they are. The electorate, you can say whatever you want about them, but they're smart enough to know a phony from the real thing. And if for 20 years your party has been consistently anti-immigrant and then all of a sudden shows up at the show and says, oh, wait a second, now that you control a significant part of the electorate, we'd really like your votes. And all that anti-immigrant stuff, we just did that because, you know, then our electorate demographics were a lot older and whiter. That's not going to work. So it's going to take some leadership now And you're seeing that in both parties. As the debate in Congress goes on with immigration reform, you're seeing both parties and members of both parties posturing themselves, and I think in anticipation of, for some of them, of a presidential run, of trying to capture the Republican Hispanic vote in the 2016 primaries. To me, I think that it's going to be very difficult for any party to win those numbers if they don't step up to the plate now. Now, the Republican Party, now that they've had the majority, the policies that we've seen come out of the legislature over the last couple of years, I think have been flying right in the face of this. You've seen legislation that targets low-income Oklahomans that are predominantly minorities. We have the perpetuation of a for-profit criminal justice system that disproportionately hurts minorities. And I don't think that having candidates that are minorities themselves are enough to overcome that. Again, the electorate's smart enough to see through that. So if you have an African-American Speaker of the House, which, you know, I've got to tell you, just as an Oklahoman, I'm incredibly proud that we have an African-American who's serving as our Speaker of the House. That's a wonderful moment in our state's history. But for that speaker to then push legislation that disproportionately hurts African Americans, he doesn't get a free pass on that because he's African American. That doesn't get you a get out of jail free card. And instead, what voters are going to be looking for over the next several years to keep up with these numbers are policies and campaign platforms that recognize the significant impact that minorities in the immigrant community have in Oklahoma and try to boost them up.
Let me just echo something you said there. I think you really hit the nail on the head when you talked about just because you have somebody of a particular race in an office or as a candidate. If you go back and look, there's been one Republican that consistently got more than 20% of the African-American vote. People are always shocked by who that was. It was Mickey Edwards. It wasn't J.C. Watts. It was Mickey Edwards, and now he took it on the chin in Republican circles for supporting Martin Luther King's birthday as a national holiday. But he consistently, in minority precincts, got 20-25% of the vote after taking that stand. And just by being active and participating, holding town hall meetings, recognize that these are people here that I want to serve. And Republicans in this state would do very well to follow his leadership that he demonstrated decades ago.
Now, there's another demographic dimension to think about, which is the demographics of place. Earlier today, Mickey Hepner observed that 50 of 77 Oklahoma counties hit their population peak in the 1930s. Demographic projections show that of those 50 counties, 25 of them are scheduled to lose up to 40% of their population in the next two generations. Okay? And they're all out in the country. Rural Oklahoma's dying. That's the only way to put it. I'm sorry. It's literally dying. 52% of Oklahomans live in the two major metros. That's projected to go to 67% in the same time period. You throw in Lawton with that, what you're going to discover is that in the major urban centers, we're going to go to having about 70% of Oklahomans living in the major urban centers and about 20% living in the country, with 10% in various suburbs clustered around Enid or around Fort Smith, for example. Barry Goldwater used to say that you always got to go hunting where the ducks are. And that's probably the best advice for the Democratic Party. They can either go fish in a pond where their voters are aging and dying and where there aren't new votes to be had, or they can go and look for votes and organize in the place where people are going to come to and where the state's going to grow. We heard a lot of affirmative talk earlier in the sessions at this conference about the great things going on in Oklahoma, especially Oklahoma City, also Tulsa, down in Norman, the places where people want to live and want to be. There are great things happening, and you have to have politics in these places too. And the voters are voting their lifestyle with their feet, either by moving within the state or moving into the state to these places and moving away from places where there is no opportunity, nothing to do, where there is literally a grocery store, a school, and a post office. And if any one of these closes, the other two are going to quickly follow. The future is going to be in those cities and in those suburbs. And as my colleague Cindy Rogers observed, if you're not a suburb, you better find a way to become one. You better find a way to connect to one of these regional centers to be part of a larger dynamic economy. And it's going to be the party that shows that way that'll win the future.
And you saw some of that in this last election cycle with Senator LeBlanc's seat, which was formerly Gene Stipe's seat, and we're in a young room. How many know who Gene Stipe is? Okay. If you don't know who Gene Stipe is, you need to Google Prince of Darkness. Because it's the title of a New Yorker article that profiled Gene Stipe, I think, in 1982. Is that right? 78? Sorry, David. I think David was the one who first gave me that article. I had the privilege of working with Gene Stipe when I was on Senate staff as Megan's intern when I was 7. But, you know, there, I don't know how much money was dumped into that race. But I think both sides easily spent upper 6 figures, maybe 7 figures total. What do you think, Pat? Do you have a sense of that? But anyway, so this is a seat that Gene Stipe, who was this powerhouse in the Senate, longest serving state legislator in Oklahoma history, maybe national.
Him and BB60 Rayburn, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Powerhouse Democrat, and I think that it was just a hard pill to swallow for Democrats to see this former seat turn Republican, but. When we look at these numbers, some things in politics are just inevitable, and that inevitability creeps up on you. And in that Senate district, inevitability crept up on the Democrats, and it got him at one point. Senator LeBlanc, the incumbent Democratic senator there, lost.
Yeah, I'll mention that it's actually going to happen. When you look at the legislature, it's going to happen quicker. It's going to feel like it happens quicker than what Keith is talking about because of redistricting.
Yeah.
Right now, we are still disproportionately represented through redistricting with a rural legislature.
Yeah.
I might be, so some people have moved, but I know at one point after redistricting, there were 2 legislators that slept in Canadian County on the House side. By population, there should have been 6.
Yeah.
Rogers County up here is underrepresented from what its population should be because of this. You know, Garfield County, Stevens County, both really overrepresented. That will change at some point because you just can't make those kind of lines and still meet all the other qualifications.
Okay, let's open it up and see if we have a question. So let me just repeat the question real quick. So the question is, how do Democrats in Oklahoma disassociate from the national stigma of the Democratic Party and get back to being Oklahoma Democrats?
You don't. I'm sorry. I mean, Mr. Webb, it's a wonderful question, but you don't. That Oklahoma Democratic identity got grown up in the 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s when you didn't have ideological politics and you could get away with being a Me Too Democrat or a Me Too Republican or an Oklahoma Democrat or a Southern Democrat. And what's happened is everything is folded onto a couple of dimensions now. It doesn't matter if you're voting for, well, in Oklahoma it still matters a bit if you're voting for president, but if you're voting for president down to state lawmaker throughout the South where these hyphen Democrats were most common, you lose as a Democrat. All Democrats are national Democrats now, whether they like it or not. So what you do instead is you play the cards you've got and you play them where you can win. And you have to do, the Republicans built their party here making the argument that if we can show that our ideas are better and we can convince voters that our ideas are their ideas, we're going to win. So you have to find that thing in the community. I do have one suggestion for you. Your generation, even though in Oklahoma 60% of people under the age of 25 voted for John McCain in the 08 election and about the same number voted for Mitt Romney, okay? Oklahoma has an unusually large evangelical youth population compared to the country, but it's stepping away from the issue side of the church and looking for something deeper. It's looking for a deeper theology, and it's also looking to put Scripture to work. So you're talking about, what you're talking about is you're talking about the social gospel. You're talking back about going back to, for example, this is one for instance, you go back to the message of Christ, use that as your vehicle to get voters to come to you and say, let's put government to work on those Christian values that we hold. That's one possible strategy. That instead of screaming and yelling about abortion and immigration, you remember that you be kind to the stranger because you were once strangers in the land of Egypt, and you use that as your vehicle to build your political movement. That's my suggestion, and I've been throwing it out there for about 10 years, and Speaker Steele and I have had this conversation before. I think that's the Democrats' best hope. is you connect where people's values are and you show how their values are your values. But until abortion gets off the plate, you're not going to have any success with anybody over the age of 40 who's a Republican.
Maybe not that it's a Republican, but I would think with independents and Democrats, you might. I would say that the first thing you do is to stop retreating because it's not working. We've watched the Democratic Party in the state of Oklahoma retreat from national issues and try to morph themselves into the exact same platform as their Republican opponent for the last decade, and maybe more, with a few exceptions. And it's just not worked. It's not a winning strategy. And if it is a winning strategy, it's certainly not a sustainable winning strategy for the Democratic Party. You might be able to get by with that for an election cycle or two, but you're not going to be able to build a majority that you can govern with that kind of a tactic. I think that when we start thinking about the move towards urban areas, when we start thinking about the movement towards urban areas, and that's where the ducks are going to be, I think that those national platforms are going to play out. While you might not win a lot of, lose some votes today being for marriage equality, I promise you the votes that you gain tomorrow by being on the right side of history with that will more than make up for any votes that you lose today. And when we talk about the abortion issue, the abortion issue is not as black and white as it used to be. This last election cycle, we watched in states like Missouri, which is a very conservative state, where abortion politics blew up in the GOP's face. Because we've seen is state legislatures, and Oklahoma leads them, moving as extreme as they can to restrict reproductive freedoms. And they've done so, I think, not only in a way that hurts women and women's health and the people that love women in Oklahoma and their families, but they've done so in a way that I think hurts them at the electorate. So it's a secondary effect. It hurts them at the electorate as well. Because when you have, when you've gone as far as you can go and you're only left with things like personhood measures, which would outlaw common forms of birth control, it leads to the types of candidates that say things that there's like legitimate rape. That's the kind of candidate that you're creating with this type of dialogue. And so whenever you want to talk about national politics, I think that it's not the reflexive reaction that most Democrats will give you in Oklahoma, but I think that you don't retreat from that. I think that you stand up for those rights. And then there are other issues that are popping up at the national level that aren't as neat, right? So like NSA surveillance. You're going to have Republicans and Democrats siding on the issue of NSA, the NSA wiretapping program. They're going to be on different sides of that deal. Working with Tea Party legislators in Oklahoma on privacy issues, and so I think that's instructive as well. Just don't retreat.
Well, I'll take a little bit of a different tack on this, and where you came with when you start talking about the Missouri race, you kind of got to where I was. I can't disagree with anything either of you said. But I will tell you, I think actually the best chance and the quickest way for Democrats to get back into power is to let Republicans destroy themselves. and the retreat actually causes that to happen. I mentioned when I talked about the closed primary system. We have voter apathy. When you have a one-party system, which we're getting very close to in Oklahoma, you start having more apathy because you don't have the combat and the excitement that generates participation. So we're looking at Republican primaries, and I'll just take you through the math. The Clark Jolly Senate seat in Edmond, roughly 50% registered Republicans. Okay, of that, only 16% were expected to vote in that primary. So that gets you down to 16% of 50%, the math, 8% of the people were going to vote in that election. That meant 4% of the people were going to decide who the nominee was. So the line I always use is think about 100 people you know. My guess is 4 of them are unstable in some way, shape, or form. And so that becomes the real concern for Republicans, is that if we do nominate like they did in Missouri, if we do these type of things, and we don't and we become anytime. I mean, the number one team loses, and it's embarrassing when it happens, and they fall far. And if my one of the things, as someone who is an advocate for Republicans and Republican causes generally, I'm on the constant call to don't get complacent. Realize we need to do something at the federal level on immigration reform now. We can't sit back and let that become something that dictates where we are as a party for the next 10 or 20 years. But it's tough. I've heard a couple of other Republicans today mention that they considered treason for talking this way. But the thing is, in Oklahoma now, we have a deep enough Republican bench. We have enough thoughtful people there that we are having these discussions. Now, does that mean we won't get complacent? No. But that's my goal.
Let's have one more question from the audience. Anybody? The question, let me repeat it just real quick for the radio, is supposedly there's a state law of 1974 that if a party doesn't present a gubernatorial candidate or that candidate does not get at least 10% of the vote, that party would go away. So we'll go ahead.
Well, what will happen? Well, first of all, if that were to happen, there would be litigation. So you'd find that law challenged in court. But second, if you lose, what would happen is you'd lose your ballot position. But then you could turn right around and you offer a signature petition for ballot line position, and then you're back in. Which I think even the Democrats have enough signatures to make that happen. But there will be a Dino running. Okay, there will be a Democrat in name that will run in some form or fashion. So it's not going to come to pass. Whether he's much of a Democrat or not is another question.
I think it's Forrest Bennett. I think Forrest is announcing his candidacy. I agree. There will be someone that ends up on the ballot. Governor Fallon is in a very comfortable position as far as it goes with being challenged from the Democratic Party to hold on to the governor's office. I think it's far more likely, and even then extremely unlikely, that she would be taken out of office by someone within her own party challenging her in a primary. I think that this law begins to raises some important questions about the way we elect people. And I think that that's kind of arcane, right, because we're often talking about why we should elect someone and not necessarily how the electoral process works. But we've got some quirks in the law. Pat mentioned that we had these close primaries in the state of Oklahoma, and we ended up with 4% deciding who was going to represent an entire Senate district. What's that, 80,000 people now? 80,000 people, 4% of them are going to be represented by somebody that 4% ends up choosing. That's absurd. And if you look at the number of uncontested races that we had this last legislative election cycle, and then the number of closed primaries, the percentage of Oklahomans that are actually being represented in the legislature and having their voices count in the legislature or for these statewide offices is tremendously small, very small. We are a state that's governed by a very small minority of voters. And I think that we need to reconsider that, both from whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. I think that that's something that should concern all of us, and we should think outside the box about the way we're electing the people that represent us. And that's everything from opening primaries to same day registration, and maybe even looking at something like a proportional representation system to add more voices into the legislature, so that we don't end up with not just a one party system or a two party system, but a system where we have more voices representing all of the opinions that Oklahomans hold. Now, I looked at my district, and it's a pretty conservative district. Yet they are represented by this super liberal guy in the legislature. I would have folks come to my office, and there was no way that I was ever going to vote the way they wanted. And they didn't have a voice. And I think that there are ways that we can govern ourselves better so that their voices and my voice and your voice are better represented.
Yeah. Just to follow, not really addressing your question, but to follow up here, as you talked about that, one thing came to my mind. On all our survey data, we asked people why you voted for somebody. And when we've talked about the issues and the values, the ideology, I think those matter. The key thing at the end of the day, 80% of people in a general election vote for someone because I like them. It's about an emotional connection, and their willingness to touch base. So I do think there's a chance for the Democrats to do that if they can have that kind of candidates that can bust through and have that personal kind of appeal, which is something you did in Seminole County, and I think can happen as well.
Yeah, it's the Brad Henry doctrine. Governor Henry always said that the most likable guy in the room will always win, and then he set out and proved it twice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Last question.
So could you guys briefly discuss what term limits mean in a political climate we have currently?
I can be succinct on this one. Term limits make legislatures weak because they get rid of expertise. They make bureaucracies and interest groups strong because they retain expertise. And it makes too many lawmakers think about post-elective employment too soon, so that the worst kind of people will often, if they get into office, be thinking about how to leverage their incumbency for the next job. Okay? Term limits are inherently bad because they take out of the hands of the electorate the ability to choose a representative. They were a great idea in the minds of conservatives 20 years ago because it cleaned out the cupboard, and now they're starting to reconsider it.
I've never been a fan of term limits, so I'm one of the conservatives that was against it from the beginning. But I also have, part of my job, I also have a lobbying firm. From that perspective, I really like it. But it's frustrating nonetheless. I think Keith hit all the points exactly there. The other thing it causes us to happen is we have the same fights over and over again because the legislators don't remember those fights before.
Right.
Yeah.
I agree with both of them entirely.
Okay. Well, thank you guys so much. Please give our wonderful panel here a big round of applause.